Summer travel season is in full swing. Consider heading south to catch a total solar eclipse next week. Joining me to help plan the trip on SkyTalk is Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. So, Derek, let's consider the logistics. Where are we going to get a good view?
In this case, we're going to Chile, in the region of Chile where we find many high-quality observatories. The shadow of the moon first touches down in the western Pacific and then makes its way across the Pacific Ocean, heading toward the west coast of South America. And the last few minutes are spent traversing that southern portion of the South American continent.
So that's on Tuesday. If one doesn't have the means to get there then, when's the next one coming to our region?
The next total solar eclipse in North America is in April of 2024. Not that far away at all, so we'll have a chance then without having to travel too far.
So Tuesday, solar eclipse. Thursday, of course, the 4th of July. And I didn't check the weather forecast, but is it supposed to be chilly? The sun's going to be pretty far away.
I think it's going to be the opposite of that. Not chilly at all. It's going to be very much warmer at that point. And that's because the radiation that we're receiving from the sun right now for the northern hemisphere is helping to heat the northern hemisphere at its greatest degree, only because the top of the Earth, the northern half of the Earth, is tilted toward the sun. So the sun's rays are far more direct at this time of year, and that means that we get much more direct heating. It also happens to be that time of year when we have the greatest number of hours of sunlight, and that contributes to the heating as well. But what you're hinting at is the fact that also on that day, at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the Earth is going to be at its greatest distance from the sun for the entire year. So on that day, we'll be at 94,507,880 miles away, give or take a few feet, versus our closest approach to the sun, which happened on January 3rd of this year, when we were just 91,403,180 miles away from the sun.
That 3 million mile difference is not insignificant. It's around a half a dozen round trips to the moon. And speaking of which, with clear skies, is the moon available to be seen this week?
Well, as it turns out, since it is a total solar eclipse, that means the moon is new on Tuesday. So as we move toward later in the week, we'll be able to see the moon in the early evening sky just after sunset, when it will be a waxing crescent. That's just perfect because over on the other side of the sky from the western side, over in the east, just as the sky's getting darker, the largest planet of the solar system, Jupiter, will become available to see. About an hour and a half later, Saturn will be rising up right behind it. If you wait until midnight, you'll have them both in the south, and right between the two planets will be our Milky Way, that band of stars we see stretching across the sky that represents the arms of our spiral galaxy.
I understand for a real challenge, you might spot Mercury and Mars.
Yes, that's going to be a real challenge. Just after sunset, over on the western sky, as the sky is really losing its last light, both Mars and Mercury are pretty close to each other, but they're down low to the horizon. However, there will be a few minutes, about a half-hour period, where one could catch them if you had a pair of binoculars, being very careful about where the sun is. It has to be below the horizon before these are visible. It'll be your most challenging observation of the year.
So with that, what magnification might one need to catch evidence of life on Mars vis-a-vis methane bursts?
You're going to need a tremendous amount of magnification for that, because indeed, it was reported recently that there has been another sort of belch of methane gas from the planet Mars up into the atmosphere, as detected by the rover Curiosity's atmospheric sensors. Now, these sensors actually caught a big burst of methane gas. Well, relatively big. This was 21 parts per billion, which isn't really a lot, but it's a lot for Mars. And this was three times larger than the previous emission of methane gas. And of course, when we think of methane gas, the first conclusion that many people would like to rush toward is that the methane is a result of a biochemical process. But as it turns out, there's also a geochemical process called serpentinization that will work on the planet Mars. In fact, does work on the planet Mars when you combine the correct type of rock with a little bit of water and enough heat, you can create methane plus a few other geochemical byproducts that could account for this. Mars is full of these rocks. They're everywhere. So if you have some rocks, water that we know is there, and heat, which we know is there, well, you have a process that could take place to produce the methane. However, if you'd like it to be a result of a biochemical process, you're going to be in big trouble because currently there is no evidence whatsoever that there ever was any life on Mars or that there is life on Mars currently. So we don't really have a biological source to point to that could generate methane on Mars. Some might argue that perhaps there's some life hidden in the rocks below the surface, but we have absolutely no evidence whatsoever of the existence of any life of any type on Mars. So for me, right now, I'm going to X off the biochemical possibility and go with the geochemical process that seems to be there and operating.
Suffice to say, where there's methane, there's methane.
Let's go with that. I like that one.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Sky Talk.